All right, welcome back. Another episode of Nashville Talks with Taylor Jones. Thank you very much for stopping in, stopping by, hitting subscribe. Whatever you do, man, to get this thing to appear on your phone every week, I appreciate it. And we're glad to be in your little queue of podcasts, telling you what's going down in our fair city, one person at a time, one story at a time. So that's what we do here. We really love our city and love the people that live here and the artistic community and the I don't know, just the community alone is enough. I think there's so many great fired up, encouraging and inspiring people here that I felt the need to start interviewing them and getting them stories documented, because if their stories touched me, then I feel like it can touch somebody else. So that's what brings us here every week. Ian, how's it going? How's your week been?
It's been a good week. I'm not really enjoying this unnatural cold snap back from 70 degrees down to snowing, but
yeah, I don't know. We can't, you know what I'm saying? Who even can predict it? I was mad when I looked up a Saturday morning. We play ball every Saturday morning. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's going to be nice. It's going to snow Saturday night, so at least we'll get the payoff of seeing a good snow. But when I get up and I'm thinking, oh, crap. And I call in. I'm like, are we still playing? And he's like, yep. And by that point, it's like, you're not going to can out because of snow. Right. You're just going to – you got to be a tough guy, right? True. So I was like, all right, I'll be there. And, of course – it wasn't so much that it was cold. It was just that everything was wet.
Yes.
The ball gets wet. Your hands get wet. And then it's – but you fight through it. We had a few extra footballs that day. But we got through it. And by the time we were done, there was no snow left. It was the weirdest thing. Like, snow melted before, what, 4 o'clock?
Mm-hmm.
Before I got home, it was already pretty much gone.
Yeah.
So, who knows? I guess when the ground is that hot, that's what happens. So, do you have a day off – today, brother, what did you do on your day off today?
Today on my day off, I've just been house cleaning, doing spring cleaning a little early.
There you go. I'm
going to start trying to renovate my upstairs. So
oh, yeah.
Starting to tear carpet out, which is disgusting.
Oh, I've done that.
Yep.
I definitely got some kind of weird cough for like the next month after I did that.
Good.
So you need to wear something, because how old's the carpet?
It's been there at least since my parents moved in.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was over 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So
I dated my carpet back on this house when we were remodeling to like 1967.
That sounds about
pretty
right.
Pretty horrible, bro.
Some great thick green shag.
Yeah. That never got vacuumed
for
years. Like, we just didn't vacuum it.
Well, I'm pretty sure the shag was white when it was first put in.
Maybe so, yeah. Might have been, but man, you know what we did? We would just roll that sucker up and throw it out the window. Just open a window. I didn't bother carting it through the house.
Oh, nice.
Around corners and stuff.
Yep.
So I rolled that baby up. Me and Kylo just shucked it out the window.
That's not a bad idea. I'll have to do that from the second floor of my house. Just throw it out the side.
Yeah, and I had the truck and the trailer just right there by the window, and just shucked it on there and took it down to the lady at the dump. She let you know, she's funny, man. Her name's Sherry. She grew up with my dad, and she's like the queen of the dump. She tells you what could come in and what can't come in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every now and then you got to argue with her a little bit. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Get your point across. You got to. It's like kangaroo court. You have to like kind of, she's the prosecutor and you have to be your own defense attorney as to why you can come in there and dump this, you know, because she's so big great on the environment, bro. I need to have her on the podcast, and I'm sure she could light it
that
up.
That would be awesome.
Dude, she, oh my
I'm sure
gosh.
There's some good stories in there.
Yeah. Then she like remembers who my dad is, and she's like, oh, that's all right. Just come on in here. So she likes to argue with him on Facebook though. They're best friends. Like if they see each other, right. But on Facebook, they just argue back and forth. I'm like, what is that? Do y'all's parents do that? Write us back in the comment section below. I'm sure they do. Hopefully not, though. Arguing with the dump lady on Facebook. No, I've definitely seen him do it before. I need to have him on podcast, too, for too long.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be writing this stuff down. Because since we got here, we're like, what are we going to do next week? I don't know. I don't have no idea.
I got you.
Yeah. So, Uber's been busy the last week. We had an SEC tournament, so I drove around in circles quite a bit last week and took people where they were going, where they needed to go, where they wanted to go or whatever. And I told Ian and Dave that I had a funny story, so now I got to deliver on that. But the other night, so this is what I do. This is my routine, okay? So in the morning, if I don't have something, whatever, sessions or some kind of musical something, then I'll just treat Uber like a 9-to-5 job. So mm-hmm. I'll get up, and by 9 o'clock, I'm out the door, and I'm going either to the airport or wherever. Sometimes you can flip the thing on at your house, and you'll get a ride like while you're cooking breakfast, which is always nice because then it's a little closer, and you don't got to wait at the airport for somebody. So, and then I'll go to like 5 o'clock, come home, eat dinner. Sometimes 4 o'clock, let's be honest. Come home, eat dinner, hang out, watch TV, whatever. We're watching Longmire right now, which is awesome.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Especially when you come across your own song in the end of the season. That was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, whoa, that's where that is. I remember that. That was years ago. But at the time, we didn't know the show from anything. But once they get on Netflix, we find it. So when it's on TV you have to pay for, we don't have that. Yeah. But when it's on Netflix, we find it.
I feel that.
But so 9 o'clock at night, I usually go back out to about midnight. Try to make another 40, 50 bucks, whatever. It's not glorious, but it pays the old gimmicks that come in the mail called bills. So I go, and it's like 9 o'clock, and before I could even like really get out the door, I got a beep at the house, which means it's somewhere close by, right? So I'm like, oh, Kyla, I already got a. She's like, oh, that was quick. And I'm like, yeah, so I'll see you later, whatever. She goes to bed real early, like, you know, to get up and go to school.
Sure.
So I go, and I hope she doesn't listen to this. Hopefully she doesn't, but this other lady I'm about to talk about. But anyway, I see that the ping is like right on the corner of like Briley and 24 by Kroger over here.
Okay.
Okay. So pretty major intersection. So like I don't really. Whatever. I'm like, I can find that. You know, that won't be a problem. So, but at nighttime, this is my trick. So if any of y'all do Uber, I call people first on the way there to see if they're really, really drunk or not. And if they're really, really drunk, I don't pick them up. I just keep on moving, cancel the ride, because I ain't taking no chance on nobody making a mess in my car ever, mm-hmm. ever. It's not going to happen. So anyway, she was cool, but I couldn't quite hear what she was saying because the wind was all blowing and it was like, fuzzy, and I kind of heard something about stranded and gas and interstate and side of the road, and oh gosh, I was like, well, where are you at? Well, I'm on the side, I'm on the exit ramp. And so I'm thinking, okay, so she's broke down, whatever, like maybe out of gas, something along those lines. So now here's where it gets complicated, okay? So Ian, if you're coming to the interstate and the interstate runs east to west, right? Well, technically southeast, or yeah, northwest to southeast. That's what 24 runs, okay? Yes. So, Briley is perpendicular to that.
Mm-hmm.
Guess how many exits you have access to when you come up to the Cloverleaf exit thing? You have that way and that way, but you don't have this way and this way.
Right.
Okay, so you can't get on the eastbound off ramp all that easily.
Right.
So I'm looking around, and I go around, and I'm like trying to find him because she says she's got her blinking lights on or whatever, and I go exit to exit. I'm turning around, making illegal maneuvers because I'm trying to figure out which place she's in, because if you accidentally go down the interstate the wrong way, you're going to have to take all this time to loop it back around to the next exit and come back. So I'm trying not to do that. So finally I see her after like 10 minutes and maybe two more phone calls. I finally find where their car is, and it's on the eastbound side off ramp. Well, I can't go just down that the wrong way and get down there to her.
You've got to go the next exit up.
Yeah, I had to go slick back down to Knowles Road and get on 440 and come back around this way to be able to make that off ramp. So they had to wait down there for like 15 minutes. Now, mind you, the whole time, they're not a half a mile from my house.
Right.
But
and you're not getting paid for this part,
no,
too.
I'm not. And not only that, but they're getting – whoever the rider is not enjoying the fact they have to wait on me either. So – especially when they just see me going around in circles around. I'm sure it looked great. But I get there, and it's like three people, and they all get out or whatever, and they're getting in my car, and clearly the car that they're in is out of gas. So I figure, whatever, it happens to people, I guess. It's happened to me. I ran out of gas in the middle of on Highway 10 somewhere between Houston and Louisiana. So, you know, that was my fault. Just wasn't paying attention. But she gets in the car, and she goes, oh, man, what a night, whatever. And I said, oh, don't worry about it. We all do it. It happens, you know. She goes, yeah, but have you ever done it as an Uber driver?
Oh, no.
And I was like, nope, I haven't. Tell I said, is that what's happening here? And she was like, yep. So the people in the
oh,
the people in the back are her riders. And now she's like doing the walk of shame, okay? Like trying to get them where they're going. Now factor back the 15 minutes that we just took to find each other, right? And so I don't know how long they've been with this girl. Probably 30, 40 minutes at this point.
Yeah.
So I took them home. They were right around the corner off of Thompson right there. Drop them off. And then I'm like, okay, so the next phase of this operation is we have to go get a gas can and get you some gas. And she had no idea what she was doing. She's like, I don't know what to do, whatever. I live in Bellevue. I don't know how to, you know. I was going to go back to Bellevue and get my boyfriend and drive all the way back over here. I said, well, don't worry about it. Look, we'll just get the gas, put some gas in the car, and then you go back home and do whatever you need to do or go keep working, whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. So we did. So we get to the gas station. She doesn't even have her purse or nothing. So I'm like, don't worry about it. Let me just buy you gas thing, whatever, your can and your gas, and we'll go back and you can Venmo me the money later. You know, fine. Let's just get through this because, like, I done got 45 minutes invested in this little project. You know what I mean? And we ain't really going nowhere.
Right.
So we did. We finally got her straightened out. She was as nice as she could be. You know, just had a baby like 12 weeks ago. You know, I could, you know, out here hustling, driving around, you know, like doing Uber for a living, I guess, you know, and stuff. So I felt kind of like, you know, it's the least you can do, I guess. But that was my story. Uber driver ran out of gas.
Wow.
And I said, how did this happen? She said, well, usually the light comes on, and this time it didn't. And I'm like, you should be waiting until the light comes on. No way. Like, that's that. When that particular light comes on, you've gone too far. You know what I mean?
Quarter of a tank, come on.
Dude, yeah. My brother, you know him.
Oh, yes.
Okay? He does not put gas in the car. Uh-uh. He does not. I mean, I don't know how many times I've had to pick him up over the years. At least, I remember at NSA, and he still right now will argue it's because he parked it on a hill. And I'm like, bro, if you get to the point where you can't park on hills and start your car, you have gone too far without getting gas.
Yes.
Because, like, I'm the guy that puts gas in it when there's, like, under maybe a quarter of a tank.
Yep.
Because I don't want to get in a situation where I get ready to jump in the car and leave somewhere and there ain't no gas in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And Kyla's starting to learn, but she used to let it run plumb out, too. But, anyway, yeah, Bruno, Katie gets so mad because every now and then she'll go to get in a, they share a car right now. She'll go to get in a car and there will be none gas. And she said, I'll just text him. I'll just be like, murder. And he'll know how angry I am about the gas. It's hilarious.
It only took one time for me to run out of gas and have to push my car up to the pump for never do that again.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that time in Houston, I was like, oh, yeah, we're almost out of gas. We've got about a quarter of a tank or less. I'll get gas as soon as we get out of Houston because, like, it's a hot mess.
Oh, yeah.
So I almost made it to Lake Charles before I ran out of gas. Mm. But I ran out of gas in the middle of nowhere, like middle of Highway 10 and in between Texas and Lake Charles.
Wow.
And we just had some poster board in the van for merch, you know, and we just wrote on their gas and just held it up. And a couple people stopped with gas. It was awesome. Nice. So it worked, but I don't know. Dave, you ever ran out of gas before?
Yeah, man. As I was just sitting listening to you talk, I thought, I've got too many of those stories. I used to have this old Jeep Wrangler, and when I bought it, the gas gauge never worked. And so I had to keep up with the mileage. And then
my dad had to do one of those.
But my gauge is broke in my car.
I found out the hard way that the mileage would, you know, differ drastically based upon if I was using the heater, if I was towing something.
Yep. Like,
different things would. So the first year I got it, I ran out of gas a couple of times. But the most kind of embarrassing story was right after. So I've got three boys. My oldest son's 6, and I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. When my 6-year-old, he was maybe 3 months old, just a little baby still. And I had him in the back of the car. I was running errands in my wife's car. And I just didn't look at the gas gauge. Didn't even think about it. And I'm driving, and I run out of gas with him in the car.
Oh.
And then I realize I don't even have my wallet on me.
No!
And so now I've got a 3-month-old, and I've got no wallet. And I didn't want to call my wife.
No, of course not.
Because I thought, oh, man, this will just confirm everything. So I get out of the car, and I walk to the gas station, which is, I mean, a quarter mile away, not far at all. But I walk up to the gas station. He's sleeping. I'm carrying him. And then I get to beg people for you know,
and you
money.
Got this baby with and, you.
Yeah, which was actually a great tool. So if you ever run out of gas, just have a baby with you.
And they're like, oh my gosh.
I'm like, hey, I've got my son. I left my wallet. I'm out of gas. And, it, you know, they don't feel sorry for you, but they feel sorry for the baby.
Yeah. They're like, and this poor baby has an idiot for a father.
Yeah.
You know, like that's.
Which is like so deeply true. it was just confirmed in the moment. But yeah, so I've had a few moments like that where run out of gas. And
that is, and I'm sure, how did you deal with that when you got home?
Oh, you know,
did you confess?
Oh, I had to, you know.
I would have.
Sydney is, she's hilarious. In kind of the way our marriage works, we love to just make fun of each other. So
okay,
when you get nice. Something like that, good it dynamic. Becomes this. Yeah, it's a great dynamic. Any of you that are counselors out there listening, we'll be your next client. But we love just kind of having that. We call it like comic ammunition, you know, where we can, we don't use it to like hurt each other, but just that moment where you can jab each other with something and get
it.
A laugh. It's so funny.
No, I love
it. I don't know if you were there on Sunday, but she always goes to the 9 o'clock service and she loves to heckle me. Like when I'm up there, preaching and teaching, she thinks it's so funny. So on Sunday, she's just like giving it to me from the crowd. And I always love it because you see new people. They're like, what's wrong with this guy?
And I'm who
like,
is that?
I'm like, that's my wife. And then everybody laugh. And that's just our dynamic. It's fun.
Well, it can be really healthy. If like laughter is something that can be like, you know, really life-giving in a lot of ways.
I feel like all we do is laugh. We have so much fun. We've been married almost 12 years. And before that, we dated 5 years, which is crazy. We've been together so long, but it's been a fun part of our journey.
Well, I'll tell you, man, when we was, I've noticed that me and Kyla, that was the first thing I took notice when we first met, was that we had a similar sense of humor. And I was like, okay, then that's a great foundation. Mm-hmm. Like if you have that, you know what I mean? Because if somebody doesn't think I'm funny, they think I'm obnoxious. Like that's just how my personality rubs people. Like I have people that are like ride or dies, and then I have people that are like, I don't really want to hang out with that cat. You know what I mean? Like that's just how, ain't it though, dude?
Yeah.
That's how it's always been. And
I'm really glad you brought that up because now that you know.
Yeah, we've brought you here to talk this out. No, but that's real though. It happens, man.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a whole lot of in-betweens, but when we were playing in the band and we were, you know, traveling in close, tight quarters together, by the end of the run, what we would figured out is that when we're laughing together, that's when everything's healthy. You know, if you're not laughing together when you're working or spending a lot of time with any human,
that's good.
It's usually not in the best situations, you know, at least with somebody like me around, you know, because if I'm not laughing and having fun, I'm worthless. Like I just need to get fired and move on, because seriously, like it's just not gonna work. So but man, Dave, thank you for coming on. I want to introduce you now.
I'm
sure
pumped.
I got a description on this here podcast, but Mr. Dave Clayton, he's the what is your official position over at Ethos, because there's a lot of pastors over there.
Lead idiot. So you know, I'm the guy that started it, and awesome. So I lead vision and teaching.
Cool.
I lead our teaching teams, and I help give vision to the family of churches that are a part of what we're doing.
Awesome.
And so those are the two big hats that I wear, and then the other one is I give a lot of time and energy to training and discipling and mentoring other church planters and leaders.
Awesome. So you just got finished with a leadership conference yesterday. Is that right?
Yeah. So part of what we do is we grab young leaders that are, you know, just have a calling on their life. And we say, hey, let us walk with you for a couple of years and just encourage you, pour into your life. And as they go along that journey, they start moving away to different places. And so the folks that were with us yesterday, they're the ones that have kind of moved on, but they come back once a month and we spend a whole day together.
Okay, cool.
Just kind of investing in them and their marriages and their life. And so they were all in town. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, awesome.
Getting to invest in them.
Awesome. So, and I want to get into the Ethos story coming up, but I'd love to like, man, let's hit the rewind button and just, I'd love to hear how you came to know Jesus in the first place, but also like, you know, where are you from? How'd you end up in Nashville?
Yeah. So I moved around a little bit when I was a kid, but home is Charleston, South Carolina.
Awesome.
And so, you know, grew up on the coast and loved that city. It was such a cool just kind of collision of old history and new life. And so if you've ever been in Charleston, it's one of the oldest cities in America, and yet it's just like pumping with young life and creativity and art, and it's got a really cool culture. And so grew up there, loved it. I love the beach, love the water, surfing, hanging out. This is kind of my vibe. And grew up there, and I'm one of three kids. I'm the oldest. My mom and dad are just awesome. Two of my dear friends and real heroes in all sincerity. And so I came up to Nashville actually on a recruiting trip for baseball. So in high school, I played baseball. And was being recruited and looked at by several different colleges. I was checking out different places, and I came up to Lipscomb, and I actually didn't want to come on the trip because my parents went to school here. And as much as I love my parents, you know, as a 17-year-old, it's just I want to do my own thing. I don't want to go where they went. And so I came up, and there was something about that trip. I kind of had the epiphany that, hey, I think I'm almost done with baseball. I'm just, you know, I could make the team, I could play here, I could do this or that, but I was just tired. I didn't realize how tired I was of just the year-round playing. But the school itself, I loved. And so I came up for a recruiting trip. The recruiting trip convinced me I didn't want to play ball anymore. but I had to kind of go home and tell my parents, hey, you know that school that I've always said I won't go to, I want to go to. And so I came up for school, and in my mind I thought, hey, I'll be here, you know, 4 years, and then I'll go back east, and that'll kind of be the story. And that's just not the way it turned out. So that's how I ended up in Nashville. I became a follower of Jesus when I was 16, and grew up in a Christian home. My dad's a pastor. My mom and dad are just, one of the things I loved about them was they never were perfect, but they were really genuine. And you know, I always tell my friends, I respected my parents, like public ministry, their public work. I really respected what they did publicly, but it's who they were privately that really won me over. And who they are privately was even so much more impressive than who they were publicly. And so that's one of the ways I think God just started softening my heart to who he was. But it was when I was around 16, through some friends and through some circumstances, I just started really wrestling with, hey, is this real? And if this is real, you know, I want to be a part of it. If it's not, then I need to find a way to get out of it. And through some circumstances, I thought, man, this is very real. And so that's kind of the beginning of the journey for me. And then over the last, you know, 18 or 19 years, I tell people it's been just a series of awakenings. And so I kind of took that first step when I was 16. And then, you know, it feels like every few years since then, God's done something to redirect me or get my attention in a new way, stretch me, challenge me, just like any good friendship. You know, so it's been awesome.
Man, I can relate to that, you know, like growing up in church and stuff, and then, but still like coming to that place of like, man, is this really real? Because like if it's real, then like I probably ought to consider it a little more seriously.
Yeah.
It probably shouldn't just be something that's, you know, a category on Facebook for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it, and gosh, man, like it's weird. Cause like for years I didn't feel that way.
Yeah.
So like what sort of made you, what was something that sort of made you go from like, okay, it's on the back burner and maybe I should deal with it. Maybe I shouldn't, maybe it's not on my mind at all, to being like in the forefront of your sort of in your walk.
Yeah, man, that's such a good question. So there are probably several factors that all happened over the course of a few years. You know, one of them, when I was around 16, I started having some just friendships with people that were a little bit older than me, much smarter than me, and they had answers to some questions that I just didn't have. And it wasn't really their answers that got me thinking. It was my questions that got me thinking. I started just going, man, you know, there's got to be something more. There's got to be someone more. There's got to be something. And so that was part of the journey. And then one of the things that really began cementing everything in my life. So, you know, I came to this conclusion, man, not only was Jesus historical, but he was good. He's worth following, you know. So some of those things really started coming into the focus when I was around 16. But when I was 19, my mom got diagnosed with cancer and got really sick. We thought for sure she's going to die. And it's about a two-year journey, and there's so many little stories within that kind of bigger narrative. But kind of in the midst of her sickness, one of the coolest things that happened was I saw a resolve in her in the midst of suffering that was beginning to solidify some of the answers I thought I found a few years earlier. And one of the coolest things that kind of came out of it was I really came to this place in the midst of some of my mom's suffering where I believed okay, God, even if she dies, you're good. And that was a real turning point. I remember kind of when that shift happened, and I thought, okay, if she dies, you're still good. And there's this kind of radical acceleration of my faith journey in that season. Kind of the neat thing, the story ends with literally a pretty miraculous healing. She's great. She's been cancer-free now for 15 years. And so everybody that knows their story, they go, oh, when God healed your mom, was that the turning point? And I go, actually, it wasn't. It's when I thought he wasn't going to heal her. That was just kind of a, that was just a really cool blessing that none of us saw coming, which is kind of another part of the story. But so it's kind of in that season, I think, mm-hmm. things really started clicking for me.
I got you. Well, I tell you, man, it's interesting. I didn't know. We don't have bullet points or nothing. We just let the conversation go. So I didn't plan on it to go down this road, but it's really got me thinking a little bit. Cause like, you know, when I think back to coming to faith and like truly coming to faith, as opposed to like, culturally coming to faith, which like, okay, I did that when I was 13 or something culturally,
mm-hmm.
but that was all it was. And honestly, that was all I thought it was, really. I just thought it was almost like initiation into a fraternity or something.
Yeah, that's what my family does. This is who we are. This is kind of the next step in the road.
Yeah, and it's a great start, I would think. Like, you know, can't be bad. But then it was like, okay, to really, on a deeper level, come to faith, it took a little bit of brokenness. And like what you say about, you know, the acceptance of God being still good, even if he doesn't necessarily heal someone,
mm-hmm.
like that's a big chunk of maturity right there that he gave you in that moment, you know? And like, to me, that was the part. Cause like, if anything bad would happen before, I would just get mad at God and be like, well, you don't care. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But at some point in the midst of whatever you want to call it, I call it feeling sorry for myself, not really depression, but that's where I was sort of living for a while. You know, it was like God showed me that, man, like he was present, he was there, he was good, and that life was worth, you know, mm-hmm. seeking out and living, you know. And my brokenness came from having everything and still not being joyful.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Because like we had a whole lot really fast, you know, as far as in our careers as like teenagers, you know, and stuff. So I got to do all the stuff I dreamed about doing before I was 21 years old, you know, playing in front of people, having records out and being praised by men and all that and this and that. But to the converse of it or whatever, is like that brought me down instead of bringing me up. So I had to get to a place of like, okay, all this stuff that I thought would do it for me doesn't. Crap, what do I do now? You know, so I don't know.
That's good.
Sorry, I'm a little bit of a loss, which is rare for me. So jump right in here, Ian, if you get a minute, but if you get an idea. But my next question is, so how did you decide, or how was it decided and shown light on it to you that, man, I'm gonna dig into the ministry?
Yeah, you know, so when I came to school, I don't know what I was, I didn't really think about what I was going to do in school, which sounds kind of crazy. I think a lot of people do that. I thought, I'll go to school because that's what you do after high school. I'll go to college. And I think in the back of my mind, I always thought I'm going to be an entrepreneur. As far back as I can remember, I've always started things and kind of built things. And that's just the way that I'm wired. And so I thought, okay, I'll go to school. And when I get out of school, I'll start something. I'll start some sort of, you know, business or whatever. And so what do I want to study, you know, while I'm here? Like, what's the thing that I want to do? And, you know, for me, I thought, man, theology sounds kind of fun. And so I decided I'm going to study that. Who knows what I'll do, where I'll go. And kind of long story short was when I was in school, I started looking around me and there are all of these people that I really cared about that just didn't have any interest in Jesus. Some of them were cultural Christians. Some of them were, you know, just there to play baseball or there because their parents made them come. And so I started just doing things to reach out to them and to connect with them and to meet them where they were. And God started doing just some really neat things. And so there's sort of this moment maybe about halfway through college where I went, man, I come alive when I get to walk with other people on this journey. I don't know if at that point I would have said, oh, it's going to be ministry, but I just realized, man, something sparks in me when I can kind of get in to the edge and help people come to faith. And so kind of through a series of events, maybe in my junior year, I began to sense the calling. And as I was getting ready to graduate undergrad, the university called me and said, hey, would you start a college ministry here on campus? And would you keep doing what you've been doing as a student? And I thought, sure, never thought of that, you know. And so it was really kind of this cool surprise, and ended up starting that and leading that for 5 or 6 years before God started knocking on the door in regards to church planting. So
awesome. So what was like the, like, because I know there's some meat on the bone here, but like, what did the student ministry look like before it was a student ministry? Was it just you just like meeting up with guys one-on-one, or how are you spending that time with them to make those connections? Or
yeah, so like before I'd actually started the ministry, so you know, it looked a lot of different ways. Sometimes it was one-on-one, you know, getting guys in the dorm and hanging out and figuring out what was going on in their lives. But you know, one of the things that I would do is I'm a big believer in, I want to create life-giving spaces. And when I create life-giving spaces, then we give God the opportunity to show up and do something great. And so I would literally just kind of throw outrageous parties. I would do things that would, you know, that were godly. They weren't, you know, they weren't what you typically think of with, you know, college parties. But I would do things that would get large groups of people together. And a lot of times they'd be outrageous. You know, I would, it's kind of like guerrilla marketing. I would make flyers and I would pass them all throughout campus. Hey, we're going to have, you know, I called it the death cage. I'm like, we're going to have the death cage in the middle of campus. We're going to have a dodgeball tournament. And, you know, I just literally rented this huge fencing company to come in. We dropped it in the middle of campus. And, you know, we'd have 1,500 students show up. And
that's awesome.
It's like we had no funding. We had no anything. It's like, hey, show up. And they'd come and they'd play dodgeball, and it'd just be outrageous fun on a Friday night. And then afterwards we'd have a dance party and a fireworks show. And I'm 19 years old, 20 years old, just doing these things. And then afterwards, you know, there'd always be this moment where I'd say, hey, if you had a great time here tonight, on Sunday night, a few of us get together, spend some time in prayer, worship. We have groups that get together. If you want to be a part of it, just come let me know. And people would go, man, like, let's try it. And God just started doing something in there. Or we'd meet people in places of real brokenness, you know. So I worked in one of our dorms as a student RA. And whenever guys would get in trouble, it's like, hey, can I just hang with the guys that get in trouble? You know, hey, before they get kicked out of here, can I just hang with them? And God just did something in those places of both joy, you know, that people would come together and just be like a huge celebration. He'd open their hearts. Or in that place of, man, I can't believe I hit rock bottom. This is going to be done. And just to kind of enter into that space of friendship. And so a lot of ministry and opportunity came out of those moments. There are other things too, but that's kind of what it looked like.
Cool, man. So then, so you do, I guess your official job, which is basically what you were doing before, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you do that for a few years. And then at some point, this idea of, you know, starting a Sunday worship gathering, I'm guessing that idea baby's born somewhere. But how did that sort of come to be?
Yeah, you know, so there's a lot of kind of factors that were at work in that. Part of it was the work that I was doing at the university. So one aspect of that work was I started trying to figure out, how do we connect with the students that don't have any desire to be here? And so I started, each year I would train a group of guys, and essentially I was trying to teach them, how do you share your faith in ways that aren't weird with people that don't want you to share your faith with them? Like, that was, because I'm like, that's all of life. Like, you know, so if I can teach you how to do that, that's going to, how can you do it in a way that's not weird? It's not abrasive. It's not offensive. And so one of the areas we started doing that was, we're in nightclubs and bars and fraternity parties. I'm like, let's just throw these guys in the deep end. I'll teach them how to interact in a space where people aren't looking for anyone to share their faith with them typically. So as we started doing that, man, we saw all sorts of fruit, just amazing things, people really being interested in God, even if they've been really hurt by religion, burned by the church. And so God started using that one aspect of the ministry to get my attention, kind of in that same vein, but on the other side, my wife, you know, she and I had gotten married a year or two into the ministry, and she was running physical therapy clinics around the city. And so she's working with a very diverse group of people. It was an Australian-owned company. Her owners were amazing. None of them were even remotely interested in Jesus, but really great people. We built deep friendships with them and a lot of the people that were in her circle. And so we just started asking the question, you know, what happens if our friends and our family and our coworkers never come to know the goodness of Jesus? Like, what happens? And as we kept wrestling with that question, we started thinking, man, they are never, ever going to come to church with us, ever. They're never going to find community where we find community. So how can we bring community to them? And so that's really the way that God started, you know, birthing that idea in us. And part of what's a little bit unique to our story is he sort of planted the seed in Sydney and I individually. And one night she and I were walking around the block, and she said, "Hey, I've been thinking a lot lately. I think we need to start a church." I'm like, "Me too." And we thought, no way is that supposed to be in Nashville, because, you know, Nashville needs another church. Like, they need another singer. You know, it's like,
oh, man, another drummer.
Another drummer. You know, I thought, this is the last place that needs a church. And so this honestly was even on our radar. We were looking and praying, and as we kept doing that, it's like the everything kept coming back to here, and we couldn't get away from it. So here we are 8 years later.
So I want to hear about Smokers Church. The first, like, you told me a story about that one time, or maybe it was from the pulpit or something. But, like, sort of, because my memory, like, it's weird how, you know how you watch, like, a movie or something, and all these people are living separate lives, but, like, they're aware of some element of these other people's lives, yeah, even if they don't. That's how I feel like the Ethos story is. And because, you know, I used to hang out at Cannery Ballroom before, years ago, you know, mm, what I mean, when it was still smoking and everything, and Mercy, like, my dad plays music, so I've always been that whatever tag along kid that was trying to, you know, that was in all these clubs and watching these older guys play, because I was just so desperate to learn. Mm. You know, so, and this is a tangent, but I can remember the darkness, you know, that I would feel sometimes, and something different now about there being a church in there now. That's a whole different building now, and that's just a guy that's lived here his whole life or whatever. It's just saying that, you know what I mean? Like, I've been before and I've been after, and it's something that's awesome about when the Lord is praised in a place. It doesn't really matter what goes on before, mm, or after. Like, he can, yeah, his spirit resides there in such a way. It's just amazing. So anyway, all that to say, like, I remember my first memories of Ethos is I heard about a church that was essentially, like, very friendly towards homeless people, towards people that, you know, were not Christians or believers or whatever, and who had maybe had drug problems or whatever. So I had heard through the network of people in town, and I wasn't even a church person at the time, like, mm, at all, you know, like, wasn't going to church at all. But I had heard, it's like, huh, well, that sort of, like, I received that, you know what I mean? Like, that's a cool thing. I was like, no, that's what a church ought to do, in all my 18-year-old wisdom, you know what I mean? So how was sort of the origins of Ethos Church? What did that look like? Because I wasn't there. I didn't see it for myself. But what did that look like from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, so in our mind, we just, I mean, we had no idea what we're doing, still don't know what we're doing in a lot of ways. But, you know, there were two things that we're really confident of, and that was that God is awesome and that he loves people. And, you know, and the closer we stick to him, the more we love people. And I know that's actually kind of, you know, disputed, because you look around our culture and sometimes church people can seem like the worst. And I've seen that and I totally get it. But, you know, those are two deep convictions in me that God is awesome and that he loves people. And so, you know, for us, we've always thought the message is pretty simple, and that let's just do our best not to screw it up. And we had no idea what this was going to become. And so it's like now we're a pretty big church. But when we're getting started, I thought, hey, this will just be my living room. And so we invited a few of our friends that were Christian, and we told them, hey, bring somebody with you next week that's not. and we're going to all be kind of in here on equal footing, equal terms. And that's really how we began in my living room. And then we moved to Frothy Monkey. We were there for 3 weeks, and then we couldn't afford rent because we had no money, you know. And then we moved out to a park, and we're outside, rain or shine, for several months. And then we moved into the cannery. But it's really just kind of that same principle. And I think one of the things that we found was, you know, human beings are perceptive, smart. We're smart creatures, and it doesn't take long to sniff through, you know, the facade and to see if whether or not that's genuine. And I would like to think, you know, I could be wrong, but I think what people were experiencing in those early days was, you know what, I think these people do think God is awesome, and I think they do think that He loves me, and that there's a space for me here, and that word just kind of spread. And that's been it's really been close to our heart, you know, ever since. So,
just kind of. So from the park, and now back in the day when y'all first started at Cannery, people could smoke and stuff in bars still, right?
Yeah.
So how did y'all deal with that on a regular, where if somebody just wants to like light a cigarette in a church, they could? Like, to me, that was just the most radical thing. I don't know why. It's not a big deal, but like.
Well, it's so funny because, so when we're in the park, you know, there's a guy who's a dear friend of mine, and he wasn't really walking with the Lord at the time, and he came and he'd help us out, and he would just like chain smoke through the services, and no one thought anything of it because we're in a park and outside, and just didn't really matter, you know. And then I remember the first night we moved in to the cannery, he came up and he said, "Hey, can I smoke in here, or do I have to go out on the porch?" And I hadn't really thought about it. I thought, well, we're in a bar, sure. Like, go for it. So there's only like 50 of us in the church at the time, and real small. So he'd kind of stand towards the back and he'd smoke. And then other people, you know, started smoking too. And it's kind of the running joke. We all remember this differently, you know. So I don't know how correct this is, you know, my joke is people started smoking just so they could say they smoked in church. But it's like each week more and more people were smoking. But really the cool thing was there was kind of this, like almost this visual vibe of, you know, man, these guys aren't sure if they're bought into what this guy's saying, but they think the guy up front actually loves them, and we're here and we're smoking. And so it was pretty hilarious, because in the early days, there were a few times. I remember this one night in particular, this family, they were awesome. They were like one of the only families that were serving and giving, and they were love Jesus. They were like totally bought in. And remember, they came up after one of the services and they said, "Dave, we love what's going on here. This place is cool. The mission's great. What you guys are after is really awesome. But the smoking is killing us. Like, it smells terrible. Our allergies, it's giving off the wrong vibe." And, they basically just kind of came with an ultimatum. They said, "Either you've got to shut the smoking down, or we've got to go. Like, we're going to have to go somewhere else." And I remember there's this moment where it was just, it's like our mission was really being tested, because I thought, these people serve, these people give, these people love Jesus, and they're getting ready to leave. And then it hit me. I thought, yeah, they're going to leave, and they're going to go to another church. They're still saved. They're going to be a great asset to another church. But, you know, if I ask these other guys to leave, they're not going anywhere else. And so we just kind of made the decision, let's let the Christians go so the other guys can stay. And, you know, a few years later, the law changed. And so then we had to shut it down because we're going to have to be a 21 and up church. And it's like,
oh my, what an odd
isn't that hilarious? And so we thought, well,
that bailed you out of the smoking thing.
Yeah. And all those guys understood it and they thought it was awesome. But what was neat was in that process, a lot of those guys started coming to Jesus, and it was really cool. So that's why we were smoking church for a season.
I love that, man. I just think that's such a cool part of the church's history and everything. So, man, Ian, what do you think, brother? You got something?
No, I was just giving you a little 5-minute warning.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, give me the 5. I thought you were raising your hand. He's you have testifying. A question, sir. Yeah. Amen. Glory. Yeah. So, I guess my last little point, and I just feel like my God's telling me to ask you this, but like, what do you have to say for somebody that's either on the fence or doesn't really agree with anything that we've said, like, you know, as far as how God views them, as opposed to how maybe like I view them or the world views them or they view themselves. Like, what's something that, and you don't have to answer this right now, but like, what's something that you that you would tell me if I asked you that question? You know, if I came to you, I said, Dave, man, like, I get it. I get everything that you're saying. You know, I appreciate it. But I'm just not sure if I can, you know, if I'm tracking with you 100%, you know? Like, what's a way that, I don't know. That's a tough question, I know, and I'm putting you on the spot.
No, that's good. So I'll answer your question with a bit of a story. You know, in Europe in the 13th and 14th centuries, there was some really amazing painting that was going on. I mean, artists were killing it. You know, it's like a real sweet time for art. And, you know, several centuries later, these pieces of art were kind of having this like renaissance, this rebirth. You know, people were finding these old paintings and like these things are amazing. And they were looking at these paintings and the color schemes and the imagery, and they thought, wow, this is amazing. Well, it wasn't until, you know, the 18th or 19th century that people started realizing that these old pieces of art from the 13th and 14th century, although they were beautiful, they'd look at them in all these muted colors and muted tones. They'd look at them and they'd say, that's amazing. It wasn't until the 18th or 19th century that they realized that the paintings weren't actually painted with muted, toned-down colors. They just had hundreds of years of dust and dirt and grime that had accumulated on them. And so it was in the 18th or 19th century they began going back and restoring these old frescoes, these old paintings, removing the dirt just kind of layer by layer. And what they found underneath all the grime and under all the dirt was the most brilliant color, the most brilliant paintings you could imagine. In fact, people travel to Italy and all places of Europe to see those paintings today. And I've thought of that a lot because I think, you know, over the last several centuries especially, but, you know, even over the last several decades here in the States, I'm assuming a lot of your listeners are from the States, there's been an accumulation of a lot of dirt and grime on the face of Jesus. And a lot of that's gotten there because of the people that, you know, claim his name. And so if you're out there listening and you're just thinking, man, this is a bunch of garbage, I just want to tell you, that makes sense. It makes sense that you feel that this is garbage. And it makes sense if you've been wounded or hurt. And you know, I don't believe that in the course of just a few minutes I could remove all of the dirt off of Jesus' face for you. But what I would say is, I want to challenge you, give the real Jesus a real shot. Give the real Jesus a real shot. And I think what you're going to discover under the dirt and grime of some of the residue of American Christianity is something very real, and someone very real, and someone very loving and very powerful. And so I think I would say find someone who is confident enough in who they are to let you share your real pain and frustrations with them, and then you be willing enough to challenge some of your assumptions about who God is along the way as well.
Amen. Well, I appreciate you for that story. That's perfect way to, man, to finish this off. And man, if you're in Nashville and you're looking for a place to worship on Sundays, I guess we got several times and
come find us.
Several locations, mm-hmm. You know, all over town. And if you, I know you can find myself at the 11 at Cannery, but there's one at Marathon Music Works, and there's one at Ruby in mm-hmm. Hillsboro Village. So if you're around and you want to, you know what I mean, come hear some more, you're welcome. Come on, please. We'd love to have
all,
you.
All are welcome.
All are welcome, man. Dave, I really appreciate you telling me your story, telling us your story, and for your time today.
Yeah.
And
man, guys, thanks for having me.
Dude, it's been an honor and a real, you know, just a blessing for us to sit here and listen. So thank you. I guess that's going to be, we're going to hit the old go home here now, folks. I hope you guys are having a great week. And we, again, thank you so much for subscribing. It helped big time help for us when you do that. And if you like what we're doing and you want to spread it around a little bit to somebody else that you think might like a podcast of such nature, then please do it. That's the way this thing grows, man. We're not necessarily working with a whole lot of resources, but I believe in the content and the people that come on here and stuff to and the stories that they have. I think they're life-giving. So let's share it all, man. Appreciate all you guys so much for all your support. And Ian, any last words there, brother?
No.
We good? Good for this week?
It's been a great one.
It's been a great one, man. So for Dave Clayton and Ian Stewart, I'm Taylor Jones. Thank you very much. See you next time.